Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
In the book of Genesis, we have it stated that God created humankind in his image and likeness. Genesis chapter 1. God made every kind of wild animal, every kind of tame animal, and every kind of thing that crawls on the ground. God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make human beings in our image and after our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, the tame animals, the wild animals, and all the creatures that crawl on the earth." God created mankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fertile and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and all the living things that crawl on the earth." So it happened. God looked at everything he had made and found that it was good. Evening came and morning followed, the sixth day. You probably recognize this passage. It's one of the readings that we read every Easter. It comes up quite a bit if we're ever talking about creation in the Bible. And in it, it is clear that human beings are created apart from, in continuity with, but also apart from everything else that is created. There is something unique, something special about human beings in the way that they're created. And that specialness is encapsulated in this phrase, "in the image and after the likeness of God." The question is, what does that mean? Does it mean that we look like God? Does it mean that we act like God? The jury's out. This is something that many fathers, many of the first commentators and first theologians of the church wrestled with. What does this mean? What does it mean for us to be created in the image and after the likeness of God? In order to answer that question, we can look at, on the one hand, the context, the historical context of this story, to see what it has in common with other cultures and how it's different from other cultures of this time period, and to see how it differs and is similar to and different from the other creation stories of the ancient Near East. So if we begin here, we can very, very, very briefly consider the fact that this story has a lot of Persian loanwords. We have some different signs that it was probably written while the Israelites were in the exile in the East, in Babylon. And we know that there's some cultural contact, we call it. There's some cultural contact with the Babylonians. We know that they also had a creation story where God creates the world and God creates humankind out of clay and God creates them in the image of God. It says it's a similar story. But there's some differences. First of all, there is not just one God. There are many gods. And these gods tend to resemble siblings because they fight about petty things a lot. Who's making noise? Who's keeping who up? Who's kind of dominating the pantheon up there? Okay, so they're kind of getting annoyed and angry. Who's going to be the king god? Who's going to be the top dog? And they kind of split up into teams. There's Marduk, and he is one of the strongest gods. And he proposes that he would like to be the king of the gods. And he's going to take down Tiamat, who's a kind of a goddess, who's the goddess of the deep waters and the chaos. And she is also a dragon goddess. But she wants, for various reasons I won't get into right now, she wants to take down the father of all of these gods. Marduk proposes to bail out this father figure, this father god, in order To do that, though, he wants something in return. He wants to be made the king of all the gods. So a climactic battle ensues, and Tiamat is defeated. Marduk kills her, slays her, skins her, takes her hide and dries it out, stretches that hide, and that's what we see up there. That's the sky. Okay, and then he takes the body of Tiamat and kind of pounds it out, and that's the earth. Her right-hand man is, I think his name is Chingu. He was her general, who also was killed in this war. He slays Chingu and then takes the blood of Chingu and drips that on the earth and makes clay figures. And that is who we are. We are the descendants of a violent creator god and this what we call a theomachy, a battle royale of the gods. Now, my point in going to that level of detail is simply to say, note a couple of details. Creation is the product of war, of chaos, of violence, and it's not certain who's going to come out on top. Okay? Think about how different that is from Genesis 1. God says X, and then there is X. God says Y, and then there is Y. It is serene. It is a demonstration of how God is one and all powerful. There is no question that the world corresponds completely to God's will. And so when God says, let them be made male and female after our image and likeness, we in fact can be confident that we do conform to God in a particular way after his image and likeness. But God also gives a couple of commands to the man and the woman who he has just created. He asks them to be fertile and multiply. He asks them to subdue the earth and fill it. And he asks them to have dominion over all the other creatures. So he gives them these three commands. Now, the first of these, that they be fertile and multiply, is a way that they share in God's creator status. God actually asks these creatures to continue to help him to create, to propagate the race, to have children after them. So that's number one. The second thing, to subdue the earth. This is in fact a technical term in Hebrew that refers to a kind of political subjugation, a conquering of territories. And it's a foreshadowing to the very end of what we call the primordial history. That's Genesis 10 to 11. And in that part of Genesis, the author is describing how the entire earth is filled with people and that they group into different communities called nations or tribes. So what he's saying to this man and woman to subdue the earth is a way of alluding to the fact that human beings are going to fill the earth with a political order and complete it with this orderly arrangement of these nations that all will have their proper place. And finally, the dominion, that there's dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and so forth. And that is another kind of political term, but it is about how this man and woman are going to reign over the other creatures. So there's a kind of royal, kingly type of imagery being used here. And that's significant, because as I just got done explaining, this is in a particular context of this cosmic ancient Near Eastern myth of the creation. When it talks about these ancient Near Eastern myths, the Babylonian myths of creation, when they talk about the creation of the king in particular, the king is created separately from all these other people. The other people are gobbled together with mud and blood, but the king is made special. He is made as God's image, as God's representative. And what that means is that the king is supposed to subdue all the other peoples. He's supposed to build a temple that reflects and shows the kind of divine temple that's up there, making present on earth divine worship and revealing the divine world up there. That's what the king is supposed to do. He's supposed to provide for right worship, but then also he is supposed to instill order among the people. So that is one person in the Babylonian myth, but it's being given to every person in the Israelite understanding of creation. Every single person is a king or a queen. Every single person represents God on earth. We do so by right worship, reflecting what is going on up in heaven, but also by moral action. By doing justice and right to each other, we reflect and instill and maintain the order that God created the world with. So there's a level of complexity to this kind of image and likeness. It is a spiritual reality, but it is also a visible reality. It engages the whole person. It is both visible and invisible, spiritual and bodily. This is the way that we are created in the image and after the likeness of God. Now, I don't know if anybody here is a Bible buff or anything. I don't know if you've ever read any of the rest of Genesis. But after God creates man and woman in his image and likeness, we have a second creation account in Genesis 2. And that highlights the fact that there's a personal dimension to this relationship. That God, first of all, planted a garden in Eden, and then he asked or commanded the first man to watch over, to keep that garden, sort of as a gardener. The first woman is meant to share in that work of keeping or watching over the garden. And the whole purpose behind this is so that God can encounter them, can meet them in the garden. God, it says, walks in the garden during the breezy part of the day. It's anthropomorphic, figurative language, but it's meant to highlight the intimacy of the man and the woman with God. That's the ideal. That's God's original intention for creation. How long does that last? Not long in the biblical record. We know in Genesis 3 that pretty quickly after they are created, the first man and the first woman disobey God and they are cast out of this garden. In other words, there is from the outset a failure on human beings' part to represent God faithfully, to represent God clearly. They are complicit in the entrance, the re-entrance of evil and sin into the world. After the original disobedience of Adam and Eve, it doesn't take long for things to escalate. They have two children, Cain and Abel. So we go from disobeying God and not paying attention to what tree they're not supposed to eat from to fratricide. 0 to 60 in about 2 seconds, right? Then at the very end of this long genealogy, there is this prevalence and spread, what some people have called a snowball or avalanche of sin. If you've ever seen a cartoon where the character takes a little snowball, like about this big, puts it on top of a mountain, rolls it down. By the time it gets down to the bottom of the hill, it's like this big boulder and like, I don't know, smacks Elmer Fudd or someone down there. Okay, completely covering them up. That's kind of how sin works, particularly in Genesis 3 to Genesis 6. It is becoming more and more prevalent, spreads everywhere, and becomes more and more a matter of violence. And God's response to this is to regret that he had created at all. So, the flood. The flood comes down, and it is a matter of uncreating what he has created. When God created the heavens and the earth, he did so by commanding that all of the waters recede so that the dry land would reveal itself. And he puts them, all the waters, in one place called the sea. What happens in the flood? God commands, and these springs under the deeps of the waters open up, and they cover the dry land. So there is this undoing of creation. The waters that are above in the heavens are allowed to come down for 40 days, so there is rain from above. There's this bubbling up of primordial water from below. And all of these creative acts are undone. But God has mercy in his righteous one, Noah. He commands Noah to create an ark. He asks Noah to get two of every kind, two of every animal, and so on and so forth. You know the story. They load up the ark because Noah is a righteous man. He obeys God. And as the floodwaters recede, there is a repetition of the commands. Be fertile and multiply. Subdue the earth. These are repeated. Noah is supposed to be that image of God that Adam and Eve failed to be. And in this respect, as Paul tells us, Noah points forward or prefigures Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is depicted by Saint Paul very much as the man and the God, true God and true man, who has been sent from the Father to restore the image, to enable human beings to represent God faithfully and without sin. So this brings us to Romans 8. I have another passage that I would like to read in this regard. For creation awaits with eager expectation the revelation of the children of God. Creation was made subject to futility, not of its own accord, but because of the one who subjected it, Adam, in the hope that creation itself would be set free from slavery to corruption and share in the glorious freedom of the children of God. We know that all creation is groaning in labor pains even until now, and not only that, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit also groan within ourselves as we await for adoption, the redemption of our bodies. We know that all things work for good for those who love God, who are called according to his purpose. For those he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, so that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. So the phrase here, being conformed to the image of the Son, is crucial. Christ came in order to redeem this entire created order, this entire cosmos, and the human person within it. We have the possibility of representing God once again, both visibly through our bodies and the way that we interact with one another, but then also invisibly through our worship. By worshiping God according to God's commands, we have the ability of reflecting divine love to other people. Jesus willingly suffered and died for all. In Romans 5, which kind of leads up to Romans 8 there, in Romans 5, Paul describes how through Adam and his disobedience, sin originally entered into the world. He says there have been through the ages, through the centuries, many, many, many different men and women who have been complicit in sin, in the disobedience that sin consists of, personal sins. But also he is talking about the state of original sin. And he's saying that despite the fact that evil has prevailed for all this time and everybody has been complicit in committing these sins, that that can all be undone through one man, Jesus Christ, coming into the world. So there is a parallel, a beautiful parallel in history, in God's plan. Through one man, sin entered into the world, and with sin, death. So too, through one man, life enters into the world. That there is one sacrifice for the redemption of all of these sins, for the satisfaction of all these sins. Christ's sacrifice is that powerful, that it can satisfy all of these sins throughout time. That's Paul's point. That sacrificial act has the power to redeem absolutely everyone. And because we live in a fallen world, Paul is clear that it also has the power to restore this created order. We have a shot at instilling and maintaining this order among ourselves through the love of God that we show to our neighbor by living the gospel way of life. This is Paul's point, that we can and ought to image God, imitate God. Another element of this that Paul is very adamant about is through the forgiveness of sins. We both stand in an unimaginable debt to God. We are all in need of forgiveness that comes through the saving work of Jesus Christ. And none of us can replicate that, and none of us can imitate that. However, we can be conformed to the image of Christ. And if we are conformed to the image of Christ, we can imitate Christ in his forgiving activity. When someone wrongs you, you have the ability to forgive. That comes through the grace of Jesus Christ. That is a key way in which we conform to the image of Christ, which we exemplify, we extend the image of Jesus Christ in the world. One final problem with all of this is that despite the fact that we have been restored, that we have been given this new opportunity through the grace of Jesus Christ to image God, to represent God on earth, we are still confronted with the fact that there are plenty of people who don't do it. There are plenty of people in the church who don't do it. There are plenty of people in the priesthood who don't do it. There are plenty of people in the episcopacy who don't do it. There are problems, right? There's still the persistence of sin and evil. So how do we account for this? The image that I like to use is that of a penny that has been corroded. So I don't know if you've ever done, I did this in like, I think it was the fourth grade. We had like the experiment in science class. You take a green crusty penny, right? Have you ever done this? Okay. But that is an image. It's an analogy that limps, I suppose, but it is an image of the power, the restorative power of the grace of Jesus Christ that is open to us, particularly in the sacraments of the Eucharist and confession, penance. Despite the fact that we err, that we make mistakes, that we continue to sin, that we continue to be exposed to this oxidization of sin and evil in the world that effaces the image within us, we have the ability to go out and to avail ourselves of the grace of Jesus Christ, to receive it through the sacraments, to receive it by forgiving others. This is all a way of saying that despite the fact that Jesus Christ has won definitively our salvation, as Philippians 2:12-18 would tell us, we have to work out our salvation in fear and trembling. We have to open our arms to receive the grace and the transformative power of Christ into our minds and hearts. That comes through the sacraments. That comes through the Christian life. Going to Mass, reading the scripture, praying, etc. We live in what Paul might call the already, but not yet. Christ has already won the victory over sin and death, but we do not yet experience it fully. So, the image of God within us undergoes transformation after death. Listen to what he says. The first man, Adam, became a living being. The last Adam, a life-giving spirit. The last Adam is Christ. But the spiritual was not first, rather the natural and then the spiritual. The first man was from the earth, earthly. The second man from heaven, heavenly. As was the earthly one, so also are the earthly, and as is the heavenly one, so also are the heavenly. Just as we have borne the image of the earthly one, we shall also bear the image of the heavenly one. For the trumpet will sound, the dead will be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. The image of God in us will be transformed and changed to an incorruptible one. One that is not susceptible of sin and death and that kind of oxidization anymore. We will no longer be able to move away from God because we will be perfectly conformed to God through Christ. Through the confirmation to the image of Christ, we will also be perfect images of God, reflecting God to one another, but also locked in this vision of God. That is what Paul is envisioning here. In summary, we've already been able to live in the newness of Christ here and now, but there is that transformation that will take place in the future. And this is how Paul describes it. All of us gazing with unveiled faces on the glory of God will be transformed into the same image, Jesus Christ, from glory to glory, as from the Lord who is the Spirit. So we will be transformed into the image of Christ, into the image of God, into the center of the life of the Trinity. That is Paul's understanding of the way that this image draws us into the life of God in heaven.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.